We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm joined by Matthew Continetti. He is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. But most importantly, for this, the purposes of this interview, he is the author of The Right, 100-Year War, American Conservatism. It's a new book. It's out. You should absolutely make sure to obtain your copy because it's a fascinating read. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
So the book spans the breadth of, I guess, what we call now the conservative movement and more broadly the conservatism in the United States. And it's focused heavily on the 20th century, although you go now into where things have taken a turn and maybe a turn back to prior trends, which is really interesting. So there's no way that we could cover all the ground in the book. I don't even know how you covered all of the ground in the book. But I do have a lot of questions because I found it really interesting. And I wanted to see if you could start by talking about, talk to us a little bit about why you think the, let's say the Coolidge and the Hoovers are, Coolidge's and the Hoovers are a good place for the story to kind of start.
Absolutely. Well, most histories of the conservative movement tend to begin at the end of World War II, and they end either with Ronald Reagan's election in 1980 or Barack Obama's election in 2008. So what I wanted to do in The Right was broaden the scope of the history and see what emerges when we look at a much wider lens. And what I found was that when we begin the story in the 1920s, we get to see what conservatives after World War II were really reacting against. Because in the 1920s, we have a period where the Republican Party really repudiated the philosophy of progressivism. Prior to the 1920s, the progressive philosophy was found in both the Democratic and Republican parties, in the figure of Theodore Roosevelt, primarily in the Republican Party. But after World War I, after the Wilson administration, the Republican administrations that come in the 1920s really repudiate progressivism. And so when you look at a president like Warren Harding, you look at his successor, Calvin Coolidge, you see the beginnings of a distinctively American conservative tradition that is anti-progressive. But you also begin to see parallels between the American right of the 1920s and the American right of the 2020s. And so I discuss this a bit in my book, and I also discuss it at length in an excerpt of the book that was published in the Wall Street Journal recently, that the Republican Party of Harding and Coolidge bears a strong resemblance to the Republican Party of Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis. It's a party that is very skeptical of foreign intervention, a party that is for restricting immigration to the United States, a party that is either protectionist or supportive of decoupling today our economy from China's. And so when we widen this picture of the American conservative movement to expand the entire past 100 years, you do see some parallels between that time at the beginning of my story and this time at the end.
One of the interesting points you make is that Harding and Coolidge didn't necessarily see themselves as like these spokesmen for conservatism. But as you say, they saw themselves as representatives of Americanism. And they saw the 1920s as, quote, normal, which is kind of mind boggling in the 2020s, because it doesn't feel like we've had something that seems like a baseline for normalcy in a really long time. But what does that mean, the sort of how they wouldn't have conceived themselves necessarily as advocates of conservatism, but more Americanism?
Right. Well, it's mainly because they didn't have the New Deal to define themselves against. And so when you think about what happened with the end of the 1920s, with the Great Depression and the rise of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Roosevelt's election in 1932 and the beginning of the New Deal, that really changes the nature of American government in a way that was unprecedented. You expand the scope of the federal government. You involve the federal government throughout a person's life. You centralize power not only in Washington, but also in the executive branch. when you also begin bureaucratizing American life, regulating it by public policy experts. So you have Franklin Delano Roosevelt come to power in 1933. He changes the nature of American government. And so what was considered just Americanism under Harding and Coolidge now becomes conservatism, because what the conservatives or the right under the New Deal era were trying to do was protect the inherited institutions of the Constitution and an older understanding of the role of the federal government, of the importance of Congress, an older idea of what the judiciary should be doing. All of this has changed with Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So when you think of American conservatism, you really have to go to the 1930s, because it's there when conservatives are reacting to what they consider to be a revolution, right? If conservatism is born out of revolution and a negative response to revolution, the right in the 1930s thought the revolution was going on with the New Deal. And since that time, conservatives have always had a very strained and oppositional attitude toward the federal government, precisely because the government that Franklin Roosevelt created was so different than what had come before it.
I can certainly imagine that it would have felt like a revolution, and in so many ways it was. The thread between the economics of Coolidge and Hoover to the Chicago and Austrian schools, and you handle both of these sort of the transition period between the 1920s and then to the Chicago and Austrian schools kind of dominating the economic philosophy of the right. What is that process? What is that process like for the right at the time?
Well, it's funny because in this period, prior to World War II, there's a huge space between the intellectuals, between the thinkers and philosophers, and the politicians. So for Harding and Coolidge, the business of America was business, as Coolidge is thought to have said, that you have a protective tariff to insulate America from international competition. But within America, you have basically a giant internal free trade zone. Very few regulations. Everyone can start businesses, minimal role for organized labor. And the judiciary in this time is defending the right to contract, right? The Supreme Court striking down laws, state laws that they think are violating the right to contract. Well, meanwhile, though, you have this intellectual revolution that begins in Austria, right? And then migrates to the West, to England in the person of Friedrich Hayek, and into New York in the person of Ludwig von Mises. And you begin to have these Austrian economists who are theorizing the case for market economics. And then you also have a group of other economists based in the University of Chicago who are making a more moderate defense of the free market, arguing against the type of cartelization of the economy and of price controls that you begin to see under Roosevelt in the 1930s. That's the beginnings of the Chicago School, out of which the legendary Milton Friedman emerges. So when I look at that period, the pre-war period, I see a huge gulf between what intellectuals are thinking about and what politicians on the ground are saying and doing. And here, I think, is another parallel between what's happening in American politics then and now, which is today we have a lot of intellectual discussion. But when you actually look at what Republican politicians are doing, it's not always necessarily connected to, you know, the latest thing on Twitter.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. And so in a way, it seems as though there's these major inflection points of the 20th century for the right, which is FDR and then the Cold War. And you spend a lot of time on the buildup and then the reaction to and the time during the Cold War. But before we get there, I wanted to ask you about the fundamentals, the essay collection, The Fundamentals, and then the fundamentalists themselves, the readers of those essays and the supporters of those essays, who saw, interestingly, a tension with liberalism, which is an argument that has been resurrected in some corners on the right, you know, since at least 2016. What can we maybe learn from their reaction to that tension all the way back then?
Well, this is another inflection point, as you say, that's very important. So fundamentalists are Christians who believe in the inerrant word of God. They are slightly different than evangelical Christians who also have an idea of biblical inerrancy. But these are subtle differences between fundamentalists and evangelicals, and they're not worth getting into here. But I would say that fundamentalist Christianity was found its name in the 1920s, reacting to liberal currents in theology, and especially the social gospel movement, the idea that Christianity called on not just charity, but on government involvement in the economy to improve the conditions of the poor. Fundamentalists were reacting to this negatively, and the theologian J. Gresham Machen was the first to kind of conceptualize that there was a hostility between fundamentalist Christianity and liberalism, that liberalism had a different view of different anthropology, different view of what the human person was. What was interesting about the 1920s is that even though these theological debates were happening, it really reached a crisis point with the Scopes trial in 1925. And even though Scopes was convicted of violating the Tennessee statute forbidding the teaching of evolution in the public schools, this was seen as a high watermark for fundamentalism. And the media treatment, the media hostility of fundamentalists really caused a lot of fundamentalists and evangelical Christians to move out of the public square, to not involve themselves in political life, which lasted for about half a century. It wasn't until really the 1970s when the fundamentalist Christians and evangelical Christians start moving in back into political life. And so this was a huge inflection point. I think we see a few trends emerging from the Scopes trial, but one is the misunderstanding and antagonism between Bible-believing Christians and the media. This is a long stand. I don't need to tell Federalist readers or listeners about this. This is going on today. And you can see it in the Scopes trial a century ago. Another is you could see the type of conservative intellectual of the 1920s was a very unique figures who were not necessarily populists. So one of the most scathing critics of William Jennings Bryan, the populist who was actually leading the prosecution against Scopes in the trial, was Henry Louis Mencken, who was a libertarian, elitist writer who was the most famous journalist of the day. And so you can see here, too, the sometimes gulf separating grassroots conservatives, in this case, fundamentalist and evangelical Christians, and the writers associated with the right. Right? I get into that in my book too, because that's a trend that persists to this day as well.
Life is already complicated enough. So what if getting term life insurance to protect your family could be easy? Fabric has moved life insurance all online. So getting a policy that's right for your family isn't complicated at all. Fabric was built specifically for parents to help you manage your family's financial future like a parenting pro, stress-free. Fabric's new lower prices mean significant savings over other providers with great policies like $1 million in coverage for less than a dollar a day. Everything is on your schedule with Fabric because it's all online. Less than 10 minutes to apply and you could be offered coverage instantly with no health exam required. Then just personalize your quote to fit your family's needs and you'll be set with high quality, affordable protection for your family. Fabric is fully backed by Vantas Life, one of the most trusted names in life insurance since 1847. So you can feel confident you're getting a high quality policy that meets your family's needs. With Fabric's online hub, it's quick and easy to track your family's finances all in one place. Get fast, affordable life insurance, create a will for your family, set up your kids' college saving plan, and even establish a rainy day savings fund. Planning for the future has never been easier. There's no risk to apply today. Fabric has a 30-day money-back guarantee, and you can cancel at any time. Protect your family with term life insurance now in just 10 minutes. Apply today at meetfabric.com/federalist. That's meetfabric.com. MeetFabric.com/Federalist to start protecting your family today. MeetFabric.com/Federalist. Fabric Insurance Agency policies issued by Vantis Life. Not available in New York and Montana. Prices subject to underwriting and health questions. Well, could you kind of flesh that point out, actually? Because I think it is a really important one, in that the spokespeople for this wide swath of the country on the national stage, in some ways and historically, has had conflicts with that, and whether or not they realize that they have conflicts with the constituency they purport to represent is a different question. But as a denizen of conservative media, I would love to hear flesh that out.
Well, sure. I don't think H.L. Mencken ever thought of himself as a spokesman for this group. He criticized it, and he was an atheist, and he made no bones about that. But I often think that grassroots conservatives feel that the people writing or speaking in positions of authority, platforms like the Baltimore Sun, where Mencken wrote, or the American Mercury, the magazine that Mencken founded and edited, should be reflecting the views of the larger movements, right? And so we see this, of course, today, when you have a writer or a pundit kind of go on his or her own path, there's a great sense among the audience saying, well, hold it. No, you need to be reflecting what we think, right? I do think one of the developments of the past half dozen years, the Trump era, is that more pundits are beginning to conceive of themselves not as independent thinkers necessarily, independent from the left for sure, but more importantly, as spokespeople for the right. Right? And that's how they conceive of their role. That's not how Henry Louis Mencken did, though. And that's not how most of the figures, the intellectual figures who I discuss in my book, thought of themselves. It's different. I think there's a blending of the political and the intellectual going on today that was not really the case in many of the historical episodes I discuss. But the right is about 100 years. So you can, in 100 years, you can find pretty much examples of anything.
Yeah. One of the most shameful moments of my life is when I was talking to like a 22 or 23 year old Hill staffer while conservative media was just absolutely embroiled in the feud between David French and Sohrab Ahmari. And I asked this Hill staffer and a couple of them actually, what they thought of it. They had never heard of either David French or Sohrab Ahmari.
Right.
Yeah, there's an amazing sort of self-obsession in even conservative media that just doesn't quite capture everything. So why do you think in the 70s, the 80s, at least the sort of fundamentalist wing, and you know, I don't want to blur the distinctions between fundamentalists and evangelicals, but it did sort of go from back to this idea that like government shouldn't be involved, that like we are individuals. The Christianity of the moral majority was very much a what some people might mock as rugged individualism, that this isn't about expanding the welfare state to help the poor and the way the fundamentals might have thought of it. So how did point A lead to point B?
Well, right. So what brought the religious right into being? And the answer is government. The answer is liberals. The answer is bureaucrats and judges. And so in the 1970s, the government began involving itself more in schooling, more in the family life education of children. And all of these themes that we see in our politics today were very much live in American politics in the 1970s. Discussions of drugs, right? Homosexuality, all these things start coming to the foreground. And so religious people begin getting defensive about it. And they realize that politics may be their only avenue of redress. And so we see a furious amount of activity of Christian conservatives going into politics in order to change these judicial rulings and these laws that they feel are interfering with their family life. and the education of their children. You don't want to interfere in family life or the education of children if you're a progressive, because that's going to spawn a populist backlash. And that's exactly what happened in the 1970s, culminating in the formation of the Moral Majority in 1979, which was so critical to Ronald Reagan's election a year later. But I will say what's fascinating about the religious right in this period up through today is that it was in many ways ecumenical. The distinction wasn't what religion are you or what sect of Christianity are you, which it had been in much of American history. Mm-hmm. It was now a kind of popular front of traditional religious believers, whether they were Protestants or whether they were Catholics or even whether they were Orthodox Jews, right? All of them combining forces to fight against what they thought was a central government and a judiciary and bureaucracy that was imposing a secular humanist lifestyle on them. Hmm. And so it's a different character to the movement than in the 1920s, because it's not Protestant versus Catholic versus Jew. It's all three groups united together against liberalism. Hmm. And that was the religious right that we really persisted for the last 40 years.
Although there's so many Catholic integralists that are now sort of echoing the points that the fundamentalists, early fundamentalists, were making about government as the sort of essential moral weapon against poverty and in favor of the working class. It's interesting to kind of see the boomerang there.
Yes, yes. I do think there's some trends on the Catholic right today that may erode this alliance, though, that's been holding between conservative Protestants and conservative Catholics. I think on the Catholic right today, there is a sense of a return to Catholic social teaching, which in some ways goes counter to traditional Protestant understandings of the role of the state, for example. So that's why I say that the popular front that the religious right presented beginning around 1979 may be coming to something of an end, or may just change into a new form. We don't really know yet.
Mm. There's a lot of good stuff about Barry Goldwater in the book, but one interesting description that you wrote is that Barry Goldwater sort of established the floor of conservatism. He at least put the floor down. Can you tell us a little bit about why you see it that way?
Well, it was very surprising to many liberals after Senator Goldwater went down to defeat in 1964 in one of the biggest landslides in American history. And he's on the losing end of that landslide. I guess it's an avalanche. He's buried in this avalanche, but conservatives are happy. Why are they happy? Liberals wonder. Well, what for many conservatives, they hadn't known that there was a nationwide community of like-minded people prior to 1964. Because after the New Deal, after the Great Depression, after World War II, conservatism was really on the fringes of American life. With Goldwater's nomination, even though he's resoundingly defeated, you see that there's millions of people who believe in him and his ideas. And so one of the popular bumper stickers of the time was 26 million people can't be wrong, right? Which it's kind of a joke because, you know, Johnson got a lot more than 26 million votes. But here we are. This is our floor. This is where we're going to start and where we're going to build from. And it's actually very interesting to see how quickly the conservatives recovered from the Goldwater defeat. 1965, William F. Buckley Jr., the founder of National Review, runs for mayor of New York City. He comes in third place, but he wins 13% of the vote in New York City. And here, too, you see, oh, maybe there's a constituency for this. And then just 2 years after Goldwater's defeat, Ronald Reagan wins his first term as governor of California, and he wins in a landslide. So now you see that the appeal of conservatism is growing, and it would only continue to grow through 1980.
Which is interesting, because if we look at the Cold War as an inflection point, it does seem, and you talk about how Ronald Reagan's distinctly kind of sunny version of populism made it palatable in a way a lot of conservatives might not have understood. But the Cold War as an inflection point is fascinating, because that's, you know, where Ronald Reagan is winning landslide elections, you know, where he's on the other side of how Goldwater lost not too long after Goldwater's defeat. And how important then is the Cold War to taking taking the conservative movement from Barry Goldwater to Ronald Reagan?
Right. Well, what happened in between them is very simple, and that's Vietnam, which was in 1964 when Goldwater lost. We had not escalated in Vietnam. We were just in the beginning of it. And Vietnam, America's experience in Vietnam, basically broke the Democratic Party apart. It broke the coalition that Franklin Delano Roosevelt had brought into power, that had won him four terms as president, that had elected Harry Truman, elected JFK, then elected LBJ in 64. It all comes apart in LBJ's full term between 1964 and 1968. And by the time we get to Vietnam and its aftermath, there's a widespread sense that America's position in the Cold War is deteriorating, that after our withdrawal from Vietnam and then our withdrawal of support from the South Vietnamese, which led to the success of the North Vietnamese invasion and the communist takeover of the entirety of Vietnam, that dominoes began to fall, and that the Soviet Union was invading Afghanistan. They were supporting communists in Africa, in Central America. Of course, China remained communist all throughout this period and up to today. And meanwhile, there's another hinge point, which is the Islamic Revolution in Iran and the taking of the American hostages there. There's a widespread sense that America was on its heels. Oh, and let's not forget, there was inflation, there was rising crime. So in between Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan, it's not so much that the conservative philosophy changed, not at all. It's America changed, and America changed for the worse. And American voters blamed liberals for this negative change. And the result was that Ronald Reagan becomes the president in 1981.
And you write, anti-communist liberals and the, quote, hard hat working class voters of the, quote, silent majority found themselves driven away from their party and into the GOP. And now, in the context of exactly what you just talked about, communists, and whether it's Nicaragua or anywhere else in the world, there's the sense that's upsetting to a lot of Americans that the country is, as you say, on its heels. And a question that, as I was reading the book, stuck out to me that might sound really simple, and maybe it is, but it's now that all of that sort of imperialism is being reconsidered by, you know, some of the more integralist voices on the right, why is it that the anti-communism of the right at the time was able to unify all of these various factions? Was it, you know, this patriotism of not wanting to see America on its heels? I mean, it seems like a simple question, but maybe it's not.
Well, one of the themes of the right, my book, is that you can never talk about conservatism in the singular. It's always a plural. It's always of groups of different types of people who are on the right. That is, they're opposed to the left. They're against liberalism in either its modern or classical form, sometimes both. And so even during the Cold War, and I discuss this in the book as well, there were critics of mainstream American conservatives' views on against communism, right? And there were capital L libertarians who were saying that conservatives had embraced the military-industrial complex in order to defeat communism, and that was bad. There were also traditionalists, some of whom resemble in many ways figures on the right today, who thought that America was itself a corrupt society and had nothing to contribute overseas. And these thinkers during Vietnam period were around a magazine called Triumph Magazine, which identified itself as a radical Christian journal and was kind of a breakoff of National Review. And I think it's interesting that the new magazine of post-liberal thinkers, many of them are Catholics, is called Compact. And they identify themselves as a radical journal, a radical American journal, not conservative, right? And I think there's a lot to that, because in America, conservatism has been associated between the end of World War II and really up until 2016 with a policy of what I call engaged nationalism. It's nationalistic. It believes in American power. It believes that America shouldn't be tied down by international organizations or multilateral institutions, but it's engaged, which means it believes in a big defense budget. It believes in forward deployment of our forces overseas to deter conflict, but also to fight over there rather than here. And it also believes that there are some alliances that are worthwhile, in particular, the NATO alliance. And so once again, all the fights that we're having today, there is historical precedent for them. And we can see the same type of critiques of mainstream American conservatism that are present today back in during the Vietnam period as well.
COVID broke the economy, and now a recession may be coming. A Federal Reserve survey broke some bad news, dating back to the 50s whenever inflation and unemployment have hit today's levels. History suggests a recession may be near. Remember what the last recession did to your retirement? It's so hard to forget. It seems like all of the time on this show, we're looking back at the aftermath of 08. So our friends at Lear Capital shared how investing in physical gold and precious metals can be a brilliant strategy against what's coming. Smart investors are buying gold and precious metals now for two reasons. One, gold can be a great hedge during a recession. And two, the closer a recession gets, the more your gold could be worth. Don't let your retirement take a hit like 08. Talk with the team at Lear Capital about owning precious metals for your savings and retirement accounts. Right now, you'll receive up to $10,000 in free bonus coins based on the value of gold coins you purchase. Visit LearFederalist.com. That's LearFederalist.com. LearFederalist.com. And of course, you chronicle what's happened after the Cold War and how that the death of that sort of shared the shared threat of anti-communism has really at least exposed the fractures that may have been there all along. Do you think they did persist, and now it's not just that they're forming or splintering, it's that they're more visible, these sort of differences in the broad conservative movement?
Oh, yes. I think the trigger, and we've been speaking about inflection points, but I think here the inflection point was really President George W. Bush's second term. And a combination of moves that Bush made during that term really accentuated the divisions and changed the nature of the conservatism in the United States, changing the nature of the right in the United States. One was that the Iraq War did not go well. And we see lingering resentment over that bubbling up beginning in Bush's second term in the figure of Ron Paul and his movement, right? Another was Bush was a supporter of comprehensive immigration reform. And that was the euphemism for a policy that would have amnestied millions of immigrants who residing illegally in the United States. The grassroots right did not like that, because there was a palpable sense that the southern border was not secure, and that also that this would be rewarding and incentivizing lawbreaking. Bush also tried unsuccessfully to reform entitlements, and he went nowhere with that. I think a combination of these three things then kind of catalyzed by the financial crisis that happened at the end of George W. Bush's term in 2008. Sent the right in an extreme in a populist direction, and the right became much more grassroots and much more hostile to any figure in the establishment, whether they were a Democrat or a Republican. And so all of these tensions, I think, were magnified beginning at the end of George W. Bush's presidency, and have only gotten, the differences have become only more acute in the years since.
I wonder, so you were at the Weekly Standard for a long time, you're at AEI now, and you've sort of been in the conservative movement. I wonder if you think that the dominance of the sort of Chicago and Austria schools that had been really at the forefront of conservative policy, and even during the Bush era, there were at least platitudes paid in that direction by people atop the conservative movement. Do you think that fundamentally led people to misunderstand what the Tea Party was, especially as it bubbled up literally in response to the recession? Although the Rick Santelli on the floor of the stock exchange, it's still a very odd speech to kind of understand. But do you think the sort of leadership of the conservative movement fundamentally misunderstood what the Tea Party was in the context of the recession, because this sort of dogma of, you know, the Friedman dogma had dominated their thinking about what their constituents believed and wanted?
I think that might be true in regard to the international economy. And here again, this is where the parallel between today's right and the right of the 1920s comes into view. I think for the Tea Party, I think for conservative populists, the government here should be restrained. It should be, you know, supportive of capitalism. It's when they look overseas and they see basically an international economy that's dominated by elites making these trade agreements that are not always beneficial in the view of voters to the people. That's where they turn more hostile. That's where they're going to reject the ideas of, say, Milton Friedman or Ronald Reagan, who was very much a rhetorical free trader, even though his policies sometimes were protectionist. So I see that there. I see that sense that the Tea Party represented the beginnings of this return to an earlier American right, because you also see that some of the Tea Party candidates that were put up, like Rand Paul, like Mike Lee, are people going to be more skeptical of elements of foreign policy overseas, like the debate we had over, say, drones attacks during the Obama era, more interested in restraining executive authority than a lot of the Cold War Republicans and conservatives had been. And then you also see, of course, the Tea Party movement and its candidates have a attitude toward immigration and stopping illegal immigration that is also reminiscent of the 1920s conservatives.
And yet in 2012, you get the autopsy, the infamous RNC autopsy. And I remember this would have been 2017, maybe 2018, at the Washington Examiner, our commentary desk had an editorial board with Thomas Massey. And something that stuck with the left that didn't really, I don't think it really struck us when Massey said it, but he was talking about campaigning around Kentucky with Ron and Rand Paul, and about how he thought that all of these voters who were flocking to Ron and Rand were just sincerely committed to libertarian values, that these were the libertarians, and it was a rising movement. We had the libertarian moment that I think was on the cover of Time magazine with Rand Paul in around 2012, something like that. And Thomas Massey said, you know, instead, they were actually just looking for the, quote, craziest son of a bitch in the race. And I know I wrote that story up, and it went, the left in particular really latched onto it. And I'm curious what you think the craziest son of the bitch in the race constituency, what are the patterns or the trends? Is that an accurate, does that accurately capture some part of the Republican constituency? And if so, has it been around for a long time?
I think it kind of gets to what I call a kind of populist rejection of the status quo and rejection of the establishment and of the elites. And there's sometimes, I think, negative components to that, which can often mean a temptation toward indulging in conspiracy theories or scapegoating people, individuals, rather than government in the abstract, or looking for kind of a strong figure who's going to bust up the whole system. This is another thread I trace throughout the right, my book. And it comes from a place of discontent and worry over the direction of the country. And so the populists often point to real issues and real problems. And the question is whether the elites, the people in charge, are going to address them and take them seriously. And the problem is that they haven't done that in the last 15 or so years in this country. And so that has made, I think, the populists even more discontent and more willing to go beyond what we consider normal American politics. And we see that in our life, our national life today.
I'll go to your introduction as we're sort of coming full circle here. You write, in time, I began teaching the history of American conservatism to college students. One day in the summer of 2017, as that day's class ended, I asked the students what had surprised them about the course materials. One young man looked at me and said, "I'm surprised that any of this exists." Can you tell us more about that experience and what you think explains it?
Well, I don't know what explains it other than we don't teach history. And I think for conservatives, this is especially problematic because conservatism in many ways is an appreciation of history. And I sense that history really matters, that we just don't show up, you know, blank slate, start everything anew, that we are inheriting traditions and legacies and institutions that deserve preservation or deserve reform, but they're there. They're as part of our history, and history can also teach us. We can learn from that experience, and I'm shocked that at the degree to which younger people on the right today don't know the history of the right, and that, in fact, even if the people who seem most interested in the history of the right are on the left. there are many, many left-wingers who devote a fantastic amount of time to studying the right. I'm like, you know, one of three people who do it on the conservative side.
Right.
And so that moment that you mentioned that I wrote about in the preface to my book, The Right, was very striking to me. Very intelligent young man. He had not heard of Irving Kristol or James Burnham or of Frank Meyer or of Brent Bozell or any of the many, many figures I discuss in my book. He had thought that conservatism was Rush Limbaugh and Fox News and Donald Trump. Now, all three of those things are also very important, and all of them are discussed in my book as well. But what I wanted to do with the right is show that this is a long history and we can learn from it. And that's why I hope people read the book. Young people in particular is why I wrote the book.
That's fascinating. And it makes a lot of sense because there is this, I don't know, especially interesting in the Trump era that people maybe don't understand the long legacy that all of this has. And that brings me to, you started with the 20s and Coolidge and Hoover, Josh Hawley, now one of the emergent sort of figures, at least in politics, of the new right, wrote his thesis, I think it was at Yale, but on Teddy Roosevelt. And he very much sees himself as a Roosevelt Republican in 2022. Is there a case for starting the book with Teddy Roosevelt? Why or why not? And what does it say that we now have Hawley as somebody who's embracing Teddy Roosevelt and in ways that I think represent a lot of his peers, even if they don't make that case sort of as intellectually and explicitly?
Right. Well, I start with the 1920s mainly because we see the Republican Party reject the progressivism that by the end of his life, Teddy Roosevelt really, truly embraced.
There was something to conserve at that point. There was a movement to conserve something that was being threatened.
Basically, to conserve the Constitution against the progressives who were going to change it, and then did when FDR became president. TR is not really a factor in my book because it starts after his presidency, after the 1912 election. Hawley, though, is an interesting figure because he clearly looks to TR and he, I think, takes on some of the progressive aspects of TR in his attitudes toward the trusts and the role of government to break up the trusts, right, or go after them. Something that Coolidge would have had problems with. So he's pointing to a different future for the American right than, say, other figures are, you know, more traditional figures. I think one of the opportunities of the 2024 election, and one reason why I'm going to be following it very closely, as I've followed every election for past 20 years, is to see what emerges. How successful is this new right? Will Josh Hawley run for president? How well will he do if he does? Or will someone else take up some of his issues and his attitudes? How well will they do? We've yet to see. I will say that one thing I found in studying Donald Trump is that despite the new right's support for him, which is really kind of a unifying factor for the new right, he's not all that new right in policy. You know, if you think about Donald Trump's legacy as president, it's
tax cuts.
It's a conservative Supreme Court, right? It's tax cuts. It's deregulation. It's defense spending he increased. And sure, he didn't touch Social Security or Medicare. And he did, use the emergency legislation, emergency powers to begin the wall construction. But he's not, he didn't go after, he didn't try antitrust against big tech, right? And
although he went after TikTok on national security.
He did, but that's industrial protection, right? Yes. That's a Chinese company. He's trying to decouple, just like he went after Huawei very successfully. He didn't do that against Facebook, right? Mm-hmm. I do think this divergence between what Trump does and what some of the new right believes is going to be very important to the future of conservatism in the near term.
And yeah, I mean, a lot of people in the new right were actually dissatisfied with the progress he made on immigration, which is always worth remembering. One last question, which would be, you're doing a lot of interviews, I imagine, as this book, releases. And I'm curious, you mentioned the left sort of obsession with, it gets really conspiratorial with like Sheldon Whitehouse being Charlie Day on the floor of the Senate, their obsession with the conservative movement and the history of the conservative movement. And I think a lot of that stems from these misconceptions that you deal with in the book. As you are doing interviews for the book, and maybe interviews with some people that are neutral journalists or purport to be at least, or even on the left, what do you find they're interested in? What are the questions that you get from a lot of those folks, as opposed to what maybe you get when you're talking to conservatives?
Well, I'd say they're most interested in the right's treatment of race. And I get into this in the book. I talk about the history of the right's attitudes towards civil rights and the civil rights movement, the changes in the civil rights movement following Vietnam and following the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. I talk about Reagan's deep sensitivity to charges of racism, and I talk about them in the book. But I do think liberal reviewers are very have this idea that the right is racist, and so they want to learn more about that, and it's very hard to convince them otherwise. despite all of what my research and these subtleties between what happened prior to the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and what happened after. And even someone like a figure like Richard Nixon, who's a very important figure in my book, you know, he was a civil rights Republican. People don't really remember that. So that tends to fill up a lot of space when I talk to liberals in the left.
That makes sense. The Hulu show on Phyllis Schlafly, which I don't know if you got a chance to watch, but yeah, the Nixon is a crypto racist narrative play.
Yes, I kind of liked that show. I thought she did a good performance as Schlafly, who is mentioned in my book, and who is an extremely important figure. And just as a side, I will say that I try to point out the contributions to the American right from women. And from Black Americans, and so I talk about Thomas Sowell quite a bit, and I talk about Glenn Lowry, and their relationship to the conservative movement, and to conservative ideas, and how sometimes that relationship was strained because of attitudes of other people within the movement. So it's a complicated subject, but I like the complexity. And I often find that others and many liberals don't. And so I'm trying to say things are more complicated, more nuanced. Let's talk about that rather than just having these kind of caricatures in our heads.
It's fascinating. And I keep saying last question, but I do have one more because we could talk about the internal debates at NR, which weren't actually internal. They played out on the pages for years. And the relationship, or you have some good stuff on Buckley's interactions with Ayn Rand and how, you know, God factored into that in the same way God ended up being at the end of the Sharon statement being in the Sharon statement. But I also wonder, there's Whitaker Chambers, for instance, was exuberant at this idea of sort of purging Ayn Rand from the pages of National Review. And Buckley shared in that and so many occasions this exuberance for, you know, purging the Birchers, whatever it is. And no doubt there's important work to drawing lines, of course. But as the left comes and sort of has these moments where they like to flatten the history of the right, do you think there was ever an overeagerness to when Barry Goldwater, for instance, has his extremism line that you talk about, extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice, and people are very uncomfortable with that, but Reagan was so sensitive to these charges of racism. Goldwater did anti-racist work, as they would say now, on his own. I believe didn't he help found the Arizona chapter of the NAACP? Was there any, in your opinion, overeagerness on the part of the right that contributed to the left's misconceptions of the right? Or I don't know. I don't know maybe how to phrase that question well, but it does seem to be another thing that's under reconsideration now.
Well, Goldwater, just a note, was pro-civil rights, rather anti-segregation in personal life. He helped desegregate the Senate cafeteria. He helped found the Arizona chapter of the NAACP. He was not a racist person, but he did vote against the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And this is, in my view, has hurt the Republican Party ever since. Why did Buckley and National Review spend so much time drawing these lines in the 1950s and 60s? It's because they understood that for conservative ideas to be taken seriously, and that is seriously in around the kitchen table, right? With everyday people who are not political, who are not ideological, but they just kind of see the news, or they turn on PBS and there's this William F. Buckley character, right? Or they open up their newspapers and they see columns by Buckley and George Will, right? And Bill Rusher and all of the different conservative columnists who start coming out in the 1960s and 1970s, they need to be removed from the fringe in order to be taken seriously. And so that was, I think, to the good, because it meant that politicians like Ronald Reagan, he too was not associated with the fringe. Mm-hmm. When most people looked at him, they saw just a very genial man who of strong conviction, and vision. And so this was important to be taken seriously by everyday men and women. And this is the danger for any ideological movement, right or left, in America, is that they get pulled to the fringe and embrace it and thus delegitimize themselves. Forget about in the eyes of the other side, but they delegitimize themselves in the eyes of the people who actually decide elections, who are not political, right? Hmm. Their independents, their families, they're just trying to get through the day. That's like me. I try to get through the day each day. And if I see somebody saying something crazy, it doesn't matter which side of the political spectrum they're on. I think it's crazy, and I'm less likely to support their side. Buckley knew that, and that's why he drew these lines.
You're saying, you're taking the controversial position that Donald Trump should not have done an interview with Alex Jones in 2015.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Probably good advice.
Trump benefits when he says less. That helps him. It helps him.
Although it depends on what the goal is. If the goal is to make people laugh, then he benefits when he says more.
That's true. There's goal of humor, and then there's the goal of politics.
Sometimes they overlap.
Sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't.
Ronald Reagan understood that very well. Matthew Continetti, author of The Right, The 100-Year War for American Conservatism, also a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Of course. Well, you've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.